Hi, I'm Will.
I'm Jess, and we are the owners of Fitzgerald's and Berwyn.
And Baby Gold Barbecue.
And you are listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
That is true, and that's where we are here in Fitzgerald's in Berwyn. Outside the Loop, I am Mike Steven, your host of this show, and this is the 1,000th edition of Outside the Loop.
Ding!
What we do here on the show is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. So if you're here and you've never heard the show, that's what we do. Surprise. And yes, this is show 1000, and we're here at the historic Fitzgerald's nightclub in Berwyn, and so excited to be here. And Will Duncan and Jess King are sitting next to me up here on the stage. They are the owners, and I mean, what an absolute treasure of a place that you have here. And I know that there's a lot of history here, and we've got some great guests. Speaking of history, we'll talk about history. We'll talk about some current events. We'll talk about music. We've got live music. We've got everything here for you. But in terms of this place, built just after the turn of the 20th century, is that right?
Right. We believe it was between 1911 and 1918 is what we can kind of pin down there.
But we don't quite know. And it's interesting because, you know, in Chicago, a lot of people can say, yeah, we think Capone was here. We think Capone was here. But we know Capone was here.
Yeah, we do know that this was a popular kind of space for them to hang out. In fact, there's a newspaper article where the mayor of Berwyn at the time actually had to shut down this place, which was called Club Ritz at the time, because it was affiliated with them. Yeah.
Wow. So who knows what went on in here?
I don't know.
We can guess.
Maybe we don't want to know. So, all right, you guys bought this in 2020, in March of 2020. What happened a week later?
Yeah, we did. We had the opportunity to take over this property on March 5th, 2020, about 10 days before we had to close for the stay-at-home order. It was interesting timing. And no one saw that coming when the property was changing hands. It was a huge surprise, but a lot of great ideas and a lot of community came together to keep this place afloat. And, you know, we got this big, beautiful outdoor patio here, and that was a really, really well used, actually. That first summer of 2020, we did about 200 concerts outside on the patio with everybody all 6 feet apart and all that kind of stuff. You know, the history of this place that Jess is a real expert on, it just kind of shows this place was built to last. You know, it's been a music venue for over 100 years through so many, trials and tribulations, you know?
Yeah, it's a cozy spot. It's a fun place, and amazing shows have happened here. But I think what's amazing is that kind of honing in on, and something I'm really fascinated by is community. And you have turned this block, essentially, this campus, as you call it, into this community hub where you have this venue, the main stage that we're on right now, but you've got the sidebar over there. You've got Baby Gold Barbecue over here. You've got the patio and now a proper outdoor stage, which is amazing. So you have all kinds of events, kids' movies, outdoor music, parties, you know, everything happens here. And it doesn't just have to be live music. This is really a community space, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely something we're going for. And really, it's just a reflection of, you know, all the things that everyone we love loves. And, you know, we got a huge team here, and a lot of the events are things that they plan, and a lot of people who play live music here. And so, you know, it's just kind of a combination of everything we love put into one place.
Yeah. And a place like this, what I always like to say is it's truly a collective effort. Nothing like this happens without every single person involved, from the musicians on the stage to the management team and the staff working here and the people hanging out here. You know, we're lucky to be in the middle of all this madness, and it's just a fun thing to watch, and it truly a collective.
When everyone here came in today, maybe you saw there was a plaque outside the door, because now this place where you're sitting here at Fitzgerald's is on the list of the National Register of Historic Places, officially recognized by the U.S. government. Yeah. So in terms of that, I mean, I know that was a really not easy thing to do. And I get it because, you know, you want it to be difficult or else everything would be on that National Register of Historic Places. But you, I know, Jess, you were digging into that history. You had to apply, and it happened earlier this year, didn't it?
Yeah, it was about a 2-year process. And, you know, everything that I dug up, I was able to get a complete history going back 100 years from the basement of the Berwyn Public Library. And that's where that started. And I used that information to do the initial application. And then we did hire more of a professional to kind of take us through the rest of the kind of convincing that this place deserved that kind of recognition. And from start to finish, it was about 2 years.
That's amazing. And I know this is a little bit of trivia here. Again, maybe when you walk out, you'll see the picture of the band, The Salty Dogs.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
It's right by the door. What year was that picture taken? In the 50s? Is that
50s.
Right?
Yeah, that was in the early 1950s.
Yeah, 1954, I think. You'll see this little photo right by the door there. That's the Salty Dogs playing on this stage.
And they were here, weren't they?
They just played 2 weeks ago, yeah.
So the Salty Dogs still kicking it at Fitzgerald's. I mean, that's amazing. And so look, before I let you go, I know you've got a lot to do here. To do this, you said you've got a big staff that works with you, a big team. But I mean, to run something like this, where there's music every day, there's something going on every day. There was the jazz brunch earlier. There's a show tonight. There's like a million things at the sidebar. There's people over at Baby Gold. Are you okay? Are you guys okay? I mean, and you have two young children about the same ages as my boys, right?
So, yeah. Right.
What's up, boys?
Hey, dudes.
Guys,
hey.
How are you?
Charlie and SJ.
What's up, guys? Yeah.
Nobody ever asks us that. Thank you.
That's why we're outside the loop, baby. What does that take? Just on a human level, give us a sense of what we don't see, right? Because this stuff we see, we enjoy the bar, we enjoy the food, we enjoy the entertainment. But I mean, what are you guys doing all the time?
We're working.
Yeah,
We're planning, and like I said, kind of taking it all in and, you know, getting staff members ideas on what they think we should do next. And, you know, right now we just confirmed the next four headliners for American Music Festival, which will be in July. And I mean, it's about like 4 to 6 months ahead is kind of what we plan for. All of it is 100% worth it. We're 100% in. We love what we do. And it's just, we're so grateful to be able to be doing what we're doing right now.
Yeah, no, a lot of people talk about the importance of a sort of a separation between work and life. And, you know, we don't experience that as much. It's all kind of one melange, one blended insanity of work and life and home. And but it's a beautiful thing. You know, we get, you know, my wife and I get to work together and, you know, envision it and have so much great help making it happen. It is taxing, you know. There's times when you really need a vacation, and then you take, you know, two nights in Wisconsin and then you come back and you get back after it.
That's right. Hey, really quickly, I was going through social media and, you know, your Fitzgerald's page came up, and there was a nice like shot of Will and Jess and their boys, and it was like this tracking shot, this video, and then the camera pulls back and it keeps pulling back, and I'm like, wait a minute, are they on a rooftop? You were on the rooftop next door.
What is
going on next door with, why were you on the roof with your kids?
Well, like we were just talking about, we're always kind of planning 4 to 6 months out at least. And so we're planning for our next big project in 2026, which will be a 30-foot by 60-foot large scale mural for the side of Baby Gold. And I promised that, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Nice.
The theme was easy to come up with. It's just a hundred plus years of live music at 6615 West Roosevelt Road. Our favorite artist, Ryan Dugan, who's done our festival posters for the past 4 years, is completing the artwork right now. And we're very excited about it. I think it's going to add a much needed presence to the strip of Roosevelt Road.
So just stay tuned for a large art installation, a mural going in right here on Roosevelt Road on the side of Baby Gold Barbecue. You guys are great. Fitzgerald's is great. Will and Jess, the owners of Fitzgerald's, let's give them a big round of applause. Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Great having you guys. So in just a moment, what we'll do is we'll bring out AJ Rosales. But again, like, if you don't know what this show is about, I get it. That's okay. I started this show with my good friend Andy Herman back in 2006. I was 26 years old. I am now 45. I just did the math. That's 19 years ago. We are now celebrating 1,000 shows. So the show is a weekly show. And I've never missed a week in 19 years. So here we are. No commitment issues on my end. Love doing this show. But I think that there is kind of an overlap. My day job is a history teacher at Oak Park and River Forest High School. So go Huskies. Just up the street here. So I get to do some history. I get to talk about politics. I get to talk about culture and art. But it's all stuff that maybe we don't see on the front page of a newspaper, for those who still read newspapers. It's stuff that is all about community that makes Chicago and Chicagoland a really incredible place. So, all right. Chicago, you know, it's a city that's really rich with political history. And sometimes that history isn't all that pretty. And around here, who you know can matter more than what you know. And politics has often operated in a very sort of transactional way around here. So where does this kind of politics come from? And why is Chicago known for it? Dominic Pasiga, he's the author of a new book called Clout City. He explores these questions in vivid detail. He's also a professor emeritus of history at Columbia College Chicago, and he is right here with us today. Please welcome Dominic Pasiga.
Thank you. Thanks, Mike. It's a real honor to be here on your 1,000th show.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to have you here. So I mentioned that I am a history teacher at Oak Park and River Forest High School. I taught a class for a while called History of Chicago. And seriously, I was showing a documentary once. I don't know what it was called. And then all of a sudden, this guy's face pops on. So it's like, this is, for me, you're kind of like a big deal, you know?
Well, I put on a little weight.
No, you look, doesn't he look great? I think he looks great. Speaking of heft, look at that transition. Your book, and by the way, here it is, Clout City. It is an excellent book. You should all pick up a copy of Clout City. You're talking about clout in Chicago. So in the context of Chicago, when we talk about clout, what are we talking about?
Oh, well, it's a longstanding kind of thing that's been going on for years and years, of course. It really, I think, came out of the cultural roots of both Catholic and Jewish communalism. It was a way of upward mobility, a way of agency for people in the beginning. Of course, over a long period of time, it becomes corrupted, you know?
You don't say.
And there are problems, yes.
So
you might ask Mr. Burke and Mr. Madigan.
Yeah, they're not doing too hot right now, right? So it's interesting because you talk about communalism, and there's a big chunk of this book, and it's kind of like a through line about religion.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, you talk about, in great detail, Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
And you say that religion kind of produces this communalism, which in a way also produces power. So I want to talk about how that translates to power, because when we talk about machine politics, let's dive into that. That's power, but that's also really from communalism. Can you explain what that relationship is like?
Well, I think it's a process that came out of this idea when people came here from overseas, from when people came from Europe, they brought with them a sort of peasant communalism. That is that you have responsibility, not just to yourself. There's always going to be tension between individualism and communalism, but to the community as a whole, to your neighbor. So you have to be loyal, and you have to understand a certain kind of hierarchy. And I went to De La Salle High School. You may not know this, but five mayors went to De La Salle High School.
Yeah, what was in the water at De La Salle, man? Five mayors, two Cook County board presidents, and this guy.
And we got a lot of Christian Brothers brandy. they kept us stoned for 4 years.
Whatever works, right?
But anyway, it was out of, you know, De La Salle taught people to be loyal to each other, loyal to their neighborhood, loyal, of course, to their church, loyal to their fellow students, and unofficially loyal to the Democratic Party. But they also taught the idea of hierarchy. Now, if you look at the Catholic Church, at the top is the Pope, right?
Oh, yeah.
If you look at the Cook County Democratic Organization, at the top is the chairman or the mayor, right?
Yeah.
Then you have committeemen and aldermen.
Right.
Archbishops and bishops. And then you have the foot soldiers, priests and precinct captains. It all fits the same kind of pattern, which, by the way, also this pattern is fit in organized crime. So there are connections here.
And maybe overlaps.
And maybe overlaps, yes.
So, you know, when we talk about machine politics, let's dive into what we're talking about here, because we hear Chicago is machine politics. And specifically, you talked about that hierarchy, that sense of communalism, the sense that, hey, I owe this person or this group something. Mm-hmm. When we apply that to politics, what does that look like? Historically, what has that looked like in Chicago?
Well, I think, you know, one of the neighborhoods I focus on is Bridgeport, which also gave us five mayors who also went to De La Salle. That area was a hard scrabble. It was a really difficult neighborhood, often compared to Five Corners in New York.
Yep.
It was, but the Irish, I mean, they came in large numbers. They had grown up under a democratic system, but that democracy was denied them. You know, Ireland was basically the first colony of Great Britain.
Right.
And so here you have this tension. So they know how the system works. They weren't able to use it. When they come here, they look at this society as it is, which is run basically by what I call parlor politics. That is the Fields and the Newberries and the Ogden and so forth. Meet in parlors. They talk about what policies should be enacted, and they enact them. It's hardly democratic. It's not democratic at all. They look at this and they say, well, wait a minute. If we organize and we vote, we will have power. And that power will result in jobs. And those jobs will result in upward mobility. And that upward mobility will mean we're going to have a better Bridgeport, McKinley Park, Brighton Park, off to the suburbs.
So thinking about that, I mean, all right, this system of loyalty. So, hey, look, I'm going to vote for this candidate because I know that this candidate maybe down the road can get me a job.
Sure.
And if I get that job, boy, I'm so thankful. I'm going to turn out the vote for this candidate when it comes time for him to get reelected. And I say him because it's usually him historically, right?
Right.
So, and in doing so, all right, so people get jobs and they're helping to put people in office. And you're right, like historically, that doesn't always sound like necessarily a bad way to run things, but it depends who you are.
It depends on who you are. And by the way, the system could also be very vindictive.
Yeah.
I read right where one West Side committeeman who lived not far from here on the west side of Chicago was originally a precinct captain. He got three jobs for a family, the wife, the husband, and the son, all worked for the city. Then they didn't vote Democratic. So he had them what they called viced. That is, they were fired. Then he bought the building they lived in, and he had them evicted.
Wow.
Then he sold the building and took a $500 loss at a time when $500 was a lot of money. And he says, you know what? It was worth every penny. They don't screw with the precinct captain. And I think that that happened a lot.
You know, it's funny because that's a more extreme kind of story, right?
Right.
But I was just thinking about growing up. I grew up in Elmwood Park. And my
that ain't Chicago.
It's not. But you know what? I would say Elmwood Park is more Chicago feeling than some areas of Chicago, depending on where you know. I mean, we're still on the grid.
But we're not talking about Hyde Park, though. So go ahead.
Right, right. Yeah. So I would grow up, and I remember my grandma, my mom's mom, mm-hmm. Would say like, "Oh, I got a parking ticket. I just got to get in touch with Rosty." And I'm like, who's Rosty? Or the snow, there's a snow situation somewhere. Like, I don't know, I couldn't get my car. I'll call Rosty. And I'm like, who is this Rosty guy? Rostenkowski.
Yeah.
As in Dan Rostenkowski, as in Congressman Dan Rostenkowski, as in the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Dan Rostenkowski. They grew up together.
Well, you know, I went through the Rostenkowski papers at Loyola. And it's interesting because this guy corresponded with everybody.
Yes.
He was amazing in many ways. And, you know, he ended up going to jail and, you know, et cetera.
Like every good congressman. Well, yeah. Every good jail for a little bit.
Every good congressman from Illinois, at least.
Right.
Anyway, but the way he dealt with people, I mean, helping people get their immigration papers set up, helping people to get out of Eastern Europe and into, and not only Poland, but other parts of Eastern Europe during the communist years, bring them into the United States.
Right.
And, you know, when President Kennedy or President Johnson came to Chicago, they landed O'Hare and they come down Kennedy, right? He had the public, the Catholic schools line the Kennedy Expressway and wave to greet them into the city of Chicago. Why? Because he also had connections with the Board of Education and with the you know, with the federal government to get them grants and so forth. And they all, so here's the other connection with Catholicism. You know, the idea of a patron. Well, the great patron saint of Catholicism, St. Jude, right? He's the patron saint of lost causes. But St. Dominic is the patron saint, I believe, of astronomers. There are all these people, right?
Yeah. You
know, that are patron saints. If you know somebody, you pray to him, he helps you through the way. I remember going to grammar school, and the nuns told us a story about this guy. I forget what his name was. Let's call him Jim. And Jim dies, and he goes to the pearly gates, and, you know, St. Peter says, "Oh, Jim, you know, you never did anything good in your life, so you can't come in." He says, "Well, does that mean I'm going to hell?" The devil says, "Nah, you never did anything bad in your life either, Jim. You can't go to hell. So you got to roam around out here by yourself forever." So he's roaming around, and he looks up on the parapet there, and there's the Blessed Virgin, and she looks down and says, "Jim, is that you?" And he says, "Yes, Mother, but I can't get in because I never did anything good and I never did anything bad. I can't go to hell either." So she takes a rosary and she throws it over the gate and she pulls him up. And she says, "But you always said the rosary, Jim. Don't worry. I know the owner." So there was this whole idea that patron. So who's your patron saint? Rostenkowski was a patron saint. The ultimate patron saint in Chicago was Richard J. Daley. He controlled 35,000 jobs.
Wow.
35,000 jobs.
Yeah.
Now, his son, Richard M. Daley, only controlled about 5,000. That's where you see the decline of the machine. Patronage jobs were the lifeblood of the machine. And now, I'm, you know, when I grew up in the 14th Ward, Eddie Burke's ward.
Yeah, right.
I lived for quite a while in the 13th ward, Madigan's ward.
Uh-huh.
I always saw a precinct captain. I now live in the 19th ward, O'Shea's ward, and I have not seen a precinct captain in 25 years. The precinct captains are gone. And you know who did away with them? Richard M. Daley. To a large part.
Yeah, you're right about that. Daley's view on government versus private public partnerships. I mean, Daley was all about that privatization.
Oh yeah.
Right. Whereas his father was saying, "Hey, we can control this if we keep this in the public sphere."
Yeah, his father would have never sold the parking meters.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Or
I was wondering when the parking meters would come up. Yeah.
Or the Skyway, for that matter.
Right.
Either. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of interesting. So where we are now, and you know, I could be here till like 9 o'clock tonight. But
I've got no place to go.
They've got another show here, so they're going to kick us out. But the decline of the machine. So where we are today, you talk about Rahm Emanuel in here. You talk about Lori Lightfoot. And certainly there's a little bit on Brandon Johnson.
Right.
But the machine where it is today, I mean, it's nowhere near what it used to be. Is it almost dead, or can you diagnose that?
I think it's probably almost dead. I think we might be in a period of one-term mayors for quite a long time. There's just no real organization. Now, you know, the CTU, the Chicago Teachers Union, and SEIU, and several other labor unions really got Brandon Johnson in, right?
Yeah.
They became the precinct captains. They flooded the neighborhoods. They rang the doorbells. They handed out the literature. They made the connection. But now those two unions are fighting. And it's very hard to keep those kinds of alliances together. I don't think we're going to see anything like the machine again. Because now what's happened? Cultural change. The Catholic Church is not the way it was in 1960. It has changed tremendously. Parishes have dissolved. Catholics have moved to the suburbs. This was once the third largest Jewish city in the world, behind New York and Warsaw, and then came Chicago. Most of the Jews live in the suburbs. Catholics are increasingly in the suburbs. I'm Polish, a Polish-American, and thank you. And 90% of Poles lived in the city in 1950. 92% live in the suburbs today. So when people come to me, you know, back in the 1950s, we had four Polish congressmen. Four Polish congressmen. There's no Polish congressman. There's no Polish alderman. And they say, well, what can we do to move back to the city? When you're split up over 150 different suburbs, you have no clout.
Well, everyone should pick up this book. It is called Clout City. It is awesome.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
You got it. So where can we get the book? Wherever books are sold?
Yeah, we can pretty much wherever books are sold, but also Amazon and also the University of Chicago website.
All right, there we go.
Which has my other books as well, so feel free.
Always be selling there, Professor. All right, Dominic Pasiga, the author of Clout City, Professor Emeritus of History at Columbia College Chicago. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you. I love music, and since I started this show back in 2006, I wanted to make sure that local music was always going to be a part of it in some way, and as you know, I also love history. So my next guest is someone who combines a passion for our local music scene and a love of history of this area into a regular column in the Chicago Reader called The Secret History of Chicago Music. Since 2014... this guy has been a regular guest on this show, and get this, he holds the record for the most appearances on Outside the Loop. You know how many times he's been on? This is his 278th appearance on Outside the Loop. Please put your hands together for local musician, amazing artist, Steve Krakow, also known as Plastic Crime Wave. Oh, look at that. He's bearing gifts.
278.
That's you, dude.
I'm learning stuff tonight. I did not know that.
My goodness. How are you?
Good.
I believe you. Let me say this. So you are just incredibly talented. This, I don't know if you saw this online or around Fitzgerald's or, I don't know, somewhere in the alley. He drew this 1,000th poster, this 1,000th show poster. Steve Krakow did this by hand. This is, I mean, I think it kind of looks like me. It does look like me. My wife thought so. So
Burke, I kind of inadvertently giving you Where's Waldo glasses.
Yeah.
I think it... pretty much, it turned out okay.
I've got to get those 1,000 glasses. Those are a nice touch. So you're an artist. You're a local musician. So what you do with The Secret History of Chicago Music, so this has been in the Reader for 20 years?
It's a bit of an anniversary for me, too.
Look
a bit
at
of a
that.
Yeah, it was in August. It's been 20 years.
20 years in the Reader. So... what you do and why I think what you do and what I do kind of really gels nicely is I'm really, like I said before, fascinated by community, by stuff that maybe we don't see in the front page of the newspapers. And you try to dig up this incredible history of bands and musicians from Chicagoland that we've never heard of, but we probably should have. That's your whole thing. How did you start this thing, man?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, I've covered like a one-hit wonder or two just because maybe people don't know who did it, you know?
Right.
Or like, you know, so maybe there's a spectrum of the one-hit wonder to the never got out of your basement. You put out one cassette in 1978 and nobody ever heard of you since. So, you know, somewhere in there. And I kind of started in zines, you know, in just always was interested in music and comics and history and just tried to sort of come up with a way to combine all those things. And in the 90s, zines were very big and very cheap to sort of put them together, Xeroxed and everything, and get your vision out there. And sort of just spilled over into me writing about a lot of Chicago stuff in a music zine I was doing and pitched it to the Reader. It was Allison True, if anyone remembers her.
Great. Yep.
One of the better editors, the Reader, and I've seen about a dozen over the years come and go, and owners, I think about six, you know. I'm one of the oldest people there in a way. And my editor, Philip Montoro, who deserves a lot of credit. He has been my editor the entire time. He's been there 21 years. And so we have this sort of simpatico bratty brother relationship where we can be very honest with each other and also kind of work together like really well.
Yeah. So what you do is you put in the research. So if it is like a teenage garage band from 1977 that maybe put out the cassette with a single that they recorded in the garage, that, you know, we're not talking about a lot of times record labels. Sometimes we are. You will go around town. You try to find that song or online now. But you try to talk to the folks who were there, who were in the room or knew someone. And you do a lot of research and you put together this story about these bands that were doing some pretty cool things that, you know, most of us just never heard of.
Yeah, it's always sort of a different research process. There's a few ways. I mean, sometimes I'm literally find a record at the thrift store. I'm like, what is the story with this? I'm looking up the names on the record, you know, because it's clearly a local thing. And then sometimes people just come up to me and they're like, hey, my dad, he was in Aura. And I'm like, oh, hook me up with your dad, you know, or just like, you know, he was in a garage band that did an acetate only. And I'm like, let me talk to your dad, you know. So
yeah.
It really depends. And then occasionally, you know, I cover like historical blues artists, like, you know, Chicago were known obviously for the blues, and they're, you know, for the three well-known ones, you know, Muddy Waters and Buddy Guy, there's like 100 that were just as cool and genuinely struggled and stuff. And those histories are sometimes a little more documented because like blues historians are some of the most intense people on the planet, as are a lot of historians. But yeah, so it always kind of varies, you know, how I'm pursuing an artist, you know.
And so, like I said before, we've been doing this on Outside the Loop since 2014, which is when I started at WGN. But you and I have a little bit of a connection before because Nick DiGilio, I was a producer of Nick DiGilio's show, as was Andy Herman, and he's out there right now. Found that out this morning, or when I walked in. So we started to do that, translate that to the radio a little bit, and it works because we dig up this music and we get to combine the music and the history.
When was that, by the way? I figured out we could kind of, what was that, like 2005, 6?
It had to have been, because I left GN at 2007 or 6, so
okay.
Maybe 2005.
You and Andy came over, we were talking about it before, brought some brewskis over,
yep.
We hammered it out, how we were going to do this segment, and kind of been doing it ever since.
Yeah, in some capacity, but
yeah.
Do you want to try a live version of it now?
All right.
Should we do it?
Whew.
Do a live version of this?
I just wrote this one, so I'm going to cheat sheet this a little bit on my phone. I mean, I've literally done about 500 of these over the years when I start to loosely do the math. Yeah. That book came out
in
compilation came out 2015. So that's 10 years old, and that's 200 something pages, and I've done one every other week since in the reader. So maybe an updated edition will happen, and it'll be like a phone book or something.
As he's getting
phone book, do we have those anymore?
Newspapers and phone books.
Yeah,
we're
archaic. You know, you're talking to a guy who likes 8-tracks here, so archaic media is, you know.
Also, I'm assuming Andy and I are the only ones who've been to your apartment in this room.
Maybe like four others.
Maybe there's a few others. Right. You have a lot of things. I call it the lair. Maybe you call it the lair too. I remember I walked into the bathroom and like just on the perimeter, you had like all of the 1980s He-Man collection.
Yes.
You've got
yes.
all these trinkets. You've got 8-tracks. You've got VHS, just stacks of VHS tapes. You've got an old tube TV. I don't even know if that works.
It was a Zenith. It finally gave up the ghost. My parents got it. It's talk about machine politics. It fell off the truck, I think, in about 1980. And my parents were Polish Jews who moved out to the suburbs. So that really, and I'm a Polish Jew who moved back to the city.
Look at that.
So there you go. I'm part of that history.
We are full circle on the program yeah. today. All right, you ready to go? I've got a little intro here.
Oh, do it.
Yeah, so if you listen to it on the show, there's a little intro. There's also some sound effects and music. I'm going to try to do this all live. We'll see what happens, you know? This is a very understanding crowd.
Yes.
So here we go. Occasionally, in the Chicago Reader, you will see the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave, also known as Steve Krakow. The strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So, right now, let's dim the lights. You don't have to. Let's fire up the old hi-fi if we have one. Here at the historic Fitzgerald's, and let us enter...
The Secret History... of Chicago music.
My mother wrote me a letter, and my father sent me just one stamp.
We're listening to some of that blues, it sure sounds like, and this profile that you have created here, that you've researched, Steve, is about a musician named Andrew Tibbs. I'm willing to bet that nobody knows who Andrew Tibbs is who's listening right now.
Anyone?
Andrew Tibbs?
Come on, somebody.
My son is 10 years old. There's no way. There's no way. So, all right. Andrew Tibbs, tell us about this. He is a musician. He's a blues musician in Chicago. He's born in 1929 in Columbus, Ohio. Tell us about the early life of Andrew Tibbs.
Yeah, he moved to the city in like 1940. His dad was a pastor and ended up ended up at a pretty famous church here. I mean, obviously, you know, how it relates to Chicago and the sort of cultural landscape is important to me, and you know, for certain ones more than others, obviously. But yeah, Andrew Tibbs started singing in the choir, as a lot of bluesmen and soul singers and such did, and like Mahalia Jackson was like performing at the church, Dinah Washington was in the choir. So like you start to realize even these more obscure people have these like huge ties to like you know people you would know, of course. But
I feel like also with blues musicians in Chicago, they you know, like, oh, I was living with, you know, Muddy Waters for a little bit. And then Paul Cotton was our upstairs neighbor. And Mahalia Jackson, it just happens to be the choir director. Like, the intersections there are crazy. And back then, everyone was just trying to make it, you know?
St. Luke's was the church, if anyone knows it.
St. Luke's Baptist Church.
Yes. And then his history is actually really tied in with Chess Records, who at the time was just called Aristocrat. They weren't even Chess Records yet, but it was the two Chess brothers, who have names so Polish and even I can't pronounce them, their real names, if anyone knows the pronunciation. they owned a club called the Macumba Lounge.
Macumba Lounge.
Yeah, and Tibbs would play there, and he played this other place around the corner, and he was like one of their very first signings on Aristocrat. And he also almost tanked Chess early on because his first single was very controversial at the time.
Yeah, so Andrew Tibbs singing the blues, African American, and this is around the like 1947-ish, right? He's gonna write a song. And this is a song that is kind of, as you say, it's an infamous F.U. of a song.
Yeah. You know, I try not to get too political in Secret History, but I can't help it on occasion. And it just kind of shows you what snowflakes the racists always have been. Because they freaked out because he did a song called Bilbo is Dead. And it was about Theodore Bilbo, who I guess was the governor of Mississippi, and then he went on to be a senator. He was a proud white supremacist and segregationist, and he just did this very deadpan song when he passed away called Bilbo is Dead. There's really nothing in it terrible. There's nothing in it that it's just sort of a very straight thing, but just by the virtue of this black man who was obviously the target of his policies singing it, Southern stations would not play it.
Let's listen to a little bit of it.
Well, I've been down to Dallas, Texas, even went to San Antonio, but when I got to Mississippi, my best friend was dead and gone. Yes, Bilbo is gone. Well, he had to put it down.
A little sarcastic there. His friend, Bilbo, is dead.
It's deadpan sarcasm, you know? Like, there's nothing truly offensive in it, but
the South wouldn't touch it.
I consider it a protest song, you know, for this day and age in a time when that was not a very common thing.
Yeah. So he's going to continue to make music, but there's some, you know, not so glamorous stuff that happens in his life. Like some things are going to take a turn. And like around 1950, he's playing around Chicago, but he is going to be arrested for a drug-related crime. We don't know what that drug-related crime was. And he had to go to Kentucky for rehab. And that's where things kind of take a left turn.
I mean, his, as you can hear, it's a sort of like kind of an elegant, jazzy style of blues that really went out of fashion too, you know? And he actually was signed to Chess when they first became Chess in like 1950, but they dropped him like really quickly. So you never really had a chance to adapt, but he put out later singles here and there. He, you know, toured around, played, you know, pretty decent clubs and pretty decent events, but just seems like his career kind of softened, you know, over time.
Yeah, so he goes to rehab, treated for a heroin addiction, and then he gets treated for that. Then he takes up drinking, and he just kind of goes off the radar for a couple of years in the early 1950s. Nobody hears from him. We don't have anything on him. But how does Andrew Tibbs end up later on in life?
Well, it's theorized that he worked for, I mean, that's the thing when you sometimes start going back with these guys, it's dudes are looking at census records and such for history, and it's not always very well documented. So, you know, I like a little mystery sometimes still in an R. As much as I love exposing their whole history, it's nice that there is a little history and mystery in the history. But his last single was 1965, and he maybe went to work for like Western Electric and, you know, just sort of petered out a bit, you know, no, not much heard from him since. But if you look, like, his work is still compiled. There was a compilation in the 2000s that came out of most of his sides, and early Sun Ra is on one of his sides
too,
which I thought was really fascinating. Herman Sonny Blount playing piano on stuff too. So, another guy who was just maybe with the right opportunities could have been more, you know?
Yeah, so he passes away in May of 1991 in Chicago. There is a compilation, the chronological Andrew Tibbs, 1947 to 51, that came out in 2002. So the music lives on, but this is a guy, really cool musician, who is in their little protest music that maybe we've never heard of, but now you know. And that's kind of what we're about here at the Secret History of Chicago Music segment. Steve Krakow is the author of that in the Chicago Reader. I love you. I want to keep doing this segment as long as we can. And you are incredibly talented. Seriously, check out his art. Check out the book. Is there anything else you want to plug? Or I mean, this is the time. Yeah, okay.
I got an art exhibition in London in January, if any you want to
road trip. Here we go. Here we go.
Come on down.
Steve Krakow, the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music. Are you having fun? Well, I hope you're having fun, and maybe our little get-together today takes your mind off of life for a bit, because there's a lot going on in the world, and I think that that can be overwhelming at times. And in a time when so many of us are facing record levels of stress, anxiety, and disconnection, access to compassionate and reliable mental health care has never been more essential. Families and schools and communities are searching for support that feels real, that feels human. And that's the mission behind Shift Behavioral Health. That's an organization built on the belief that mental health care should be accessible long before someone reaches a crisis point. Holly Branshaft White and Jenya Jovankin are the founders of Shift. They combine their clinical expertise and leadership experience to create the first urgent care for mental health treatment in Chicago. Put your hands together for Jenya and Holly. Welcome. How are you doing?
We're so good. Happy to be here.
It's great to have you both here. So, look, I said this is a crazy time, and, you know, man, I feel like every time I open my phone, there's something that's not great. And that, I think, can compound, especially if you're a younger person that is constantly seeing this stuff, right? So in terms of where we are with mental health, just sort of in an overview here, I know that people say, well, this is on the rise, and we're seeing more of this. Is it like we're talking about it more? We're noticing this more? Because mental health issues have always been a thing because we're human. But in terms of, you know, what we're seeing and why we're seeing it, are we just aware of this more acutely?
I think so. I mean, I think that there is like a collective awareness that things are complicated in the world. And I think that people are maybe more attuned to how they're feeling, how the people around them are feeling, and certainly the news, I think, highlights a lot of what's going on related to that. And I think just more of an openness to exploring that and discussing it more openly. I think that that's happening a lot in schools. I think it's happening a lot in different environments, and I think it just makes people feel more comfortable and normalizes that life is complicated and hard, and I think talking about it openly certainly alleviates some of that weight, so...
And sometimes you just need help.
Yeah.
You know, and like when you get sick, you go to the doctor when it's a physical ailment. But that stigma around mental health, does that stigma still exist as it has been, I think, over, you know, how many years? But is that still something that you're seeing with what you're doing with this kind of work, that stigma around mental health?
You know, I think so. I think slowly it's being chipped away. I think that just kind of... going back to that openness, just realizing that life is complicated, and you know, something that we're doing and trying to bring awareness to is that a crisis can look different for everybody. Certainly there's the kind of, I would call it like a capital C crisis that maybe we're more familiar with, right? Like really struggling with depression or anxiety. And I think that can be more visible oftentimes, but I think it's really the like small or like lowercase c crises that could just be like, I don't know, work is tough, or, you know, relationships are hard, or I'm going through a divorce, or I'm really struggling to manage my workload in addition to three kids, or whatever the case may be. And that, I don't think, falls in the category of crisis necessarily, but certainly, like, personally, it can feel like that. And for that reason, it is. So
what you do with Shift Behavioral Health, this is the first urgent care for mental health in Chicago. So tell us how this works, because I think a lot of us would know like what an urgent care center looks like for a physical ailment when we get sick or something happens, but this is for mental health. So tell us, explain to us how this works and what does this look like?
Great question. So I myself am a licensed clinical social worker and spent the last 10 years working in hospitals around the city. Spent time at Lurie Children's in the ER, over at County in the ER, University of Chicago in the ER, supporting individuals coming in for really anything that would be seen in an ER. Certainly mental health crises, could be violence intervention, it could be a motor vehicle collision. And all of the families who are coming in are struggling in the moment. And what I saw over that time, and definitely during the pandemic, is that the ER has turned into much more of like a primary care space, a catch-all for people. You know, schools send families to the emergency department, primary care physicians send families. And I think just your average person is thinking, I'm going through something really tough. That's probably the place to go. It's open 24 hours. So together, Jen and I really were interested in creating an alternative to that. I think that there's definitely a lot of value to still going to the emergency department for those scenarios where, you know, related to mental health, there are concerns for risk of harm to self or to others, right? That's kind of like a very clear delineation, but things like struggling with panic attacks or just feelings of overwhelm, or even something that feels a little bit trickier to decipher, like changes in mood, or I was sleeping a lot and now I can't get any sleep, or I refuse to go to school because I'm too anxious. I think those things can be a little bit fuzzy, and ultimately coming to us can be a nice alternative.
Okay, so in terms of like when we would go there, so you're in River North, right? So, Jenya, you're the kind of operations of all this. So if someone is struggling, what's that process like? Do they just walk in, or how does that work?
Yes, we are open 7 days a week. You can walk in, or you can schedule ahead on our website. You can give us a call, whatever is easiest. But yeah, essentially you can come in for a crisis assessment, for therapy, if you need medication management that day, if you just want to have a one-time chat, you can walk right in and a member of our team will be able to assist right away. And I also want to point out that our space looks nothing like a standard urgent care or a hospital.
I was going to ask you, yeah.
It's a beautiful space, newly built. It's very modern. It's very contemporary. And it's the kind of place where, especially for young people, where you feel at ease, not at all clinical. So we're very proud of that. And I think it also kind of helps to fight the stigma a little bit more and just make it very accessible and comfy.
Yeah. And what's your address in River North?
730 North Franklin Street.
730 North Franklin. So if someone's struggling, they can come in off the street and they can see a social worker, some licensed professional to talk through what they need to talk through. Is there any kind of follow-up, or what happens when someone goes through Shift Behavioral Health? Because I know that, you know, when someone's having a mental health episode, it's not necessarily like, that's it. It might continue later on. Is there any sort of follow-up there?
Yeah, definitely. That's, I think, something that we really try to prioritize. I think just making sure that we're evaluating what the need is in the moment, like you're saying, and then supporting them moving forward. So almost all of our services include a treatment plan. You know, we make recommendations and really try to connect people to whether it's a provider with our team or somewhere in the community, depending on what is going on. Also really big into just like phone check-ins to see how people are doing. I think just having a sort of like a human touch to things, especially related to mental health and like emotional distress, just makes such a big difference. And those are not automated. It's just usually myself or Jen or one of our colleagues calling and saying, hey, we saw you last week and we talked about, you know, that tough thing. How is it feeling? Do you need more support? And we've been doing a lot of that, honestly, just by answering the phone for people who are curious about what we're doing. We've had a lot of parents call saying that, you know, they're struggling in a crisis actively, and we've talked through, you know, with them what steps would look like. So just making ourselves available to offer insight and guidance as much as we can.
this idea, it seems like it makes so much sense. And you're the first ones in Chicago doing this. So how did you pull all this together? I know your background, but to do that, to say, hey, we're going to create this place where people can come and we can really treat them, you know, if they're going through a mental health crisis, where did that come from? That idea.
That is a good question.
Well, that's why I do this job. Yeah. And here we are.
You've done this before.
I've done a thousand times. Yeah, right.
I didn't even, that was just on the fly.
Look at that.
You know, I think that as far as, I think a big part of it was trusting what we've seen out there with the people that we've worked with. You know, meeting with families who are coming into the ER, waiting for 3+ hours to be seen by me or one of my colleagues, and we go through all the steps, but ultimately when that person is discharged, we think, oh my gosh, we could have seen them like 4 hours ago and gotten them out. And it's just the ER is just not set up to manage that sort of need or to expedite that sort of care. And I think, you know, all the spaces I've worked in work very diligently to provide that kind of support, but it's just not, it doesn't have to be, you know, I don't think the best space for that. So I think the big piece was just trusting that we've seen that there's a need and going with that. I don't know. Yeah, John.
Yeah, I mean, I think combined, we have 2 decades of experience in behavioral health, and we saw a problem, and we spent a full year doing research with the community, with schools, teachers, parents, primary care physicians, therapists, psychiatrists, and everyone across the board said, yes, there's absolutely a need for it. It's a problem that needs to be solving. And we know we both have our Kellogg MBAs, and we kind of put our heads together and said, we're going to go for it, and we're going to solve this for the Chicago community, and we're very excited to be doing that.
Do you think this is part of a larger sort of reframing or rethinking of mental health in this country?
I think so. I think so. I mean, one of our services is the chat. It's in person, but it is just a one-off conversation. So, you know, you could come in following, honestly, anything. We had somebody last week who was just pregnant and stressed out. And they came in for a one-time conversation. I think that just makes it a lot less daunting. Maybe you generally are doing well and life just feels hard and you need like that kind of spot treatment or care at your own pace. And I think there is a movement towards like, what does accessibility look like? I think in this case, accessibility looks like being able to walk in and talk to somebody. It is a beautiful space. It's also a very discreet process. You can schedule, come in and leave, and hopefully you come back because you feel supported. But ultimately it offers, I think, that flexibility where you're not necessarily tied into once a week therapy and something that just feels like more involved. Maybe that's not where you are, you know? So.
Yeah. I think it's a great idea. So Shift Behavioral Health is at 730 North Franklin in the River North neighborhood in Chicago. The website, SHFT, so you left the I out, SHFTBH.com. We'll link up to that, of course. But this is really, I think, an important conversation to have, an important topic. And what you're doing is really important work for all of us who are maybe struggling at times. So please put your hands together for Holly Brandshaft-White and Jenya Yovankin, the founders of Shift Behavioral Health. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Yeah, cool. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Oh, hi.
Hi, I just thought I'd seat myself.
Yeah. This is my wife, Jenny. So what are you up to?
You know, just managing the children and the door slamming.
Yeah, I heard a scream, and I'm like, that's one of mine.
Well, no, I'm producing. I hope I'm getting a producing credit
for
this. You
are definitely getting a producer credit.
Thank you, yeah.
She's done a lot of work behind the scenes. I mean, we have a tablecloth, for goodness sake. That was not me. That was not me.
I think Marlene Wells at WGN Radio, who is a promotions legend, would be proud of the table. Shout out to Marlene.
We should use this at home. This will be nice.
Sure. Thanksgiving dinner.
That's right. So, you told me, we're kind of wrapping up here, but you said at the end, you just wanted to do something. I don't know. I kind of know what it is. Well, I don't know what you...
Okay, well...
You just do it. I don't know.
Right, yeah. I'll just take over here.
Go ahead.
You've been working so hard. Like, take a break.
I guess.
Well, so a couple of months ago when we were planning this event, and I was kind of Mike's, you know, brainstormer, we were kind of co-creating ideas for what to do for this event, and I had the idea, and I said, would you let me... like fully produce the last segment, like do like a mystery guest or something like that. And Mike, to his credit, said, sure. And so he kind of let me run with it. And so the first the idea that I had was I was like reflecting a lot about 1,000 shows, right? Like 20 years. Like, it's incredible. Like, that's just, I mean, give it up for Mike. Like, I mean,
thank you.
The fact that you have stayed so committed to this, I liked your little commitment joke before. That was funny. It's really...
Still got it after all these years. My material still works, still lands.
I just thought it was it's such a testament, and I was doing a lot of kind of like nostalgic reflection on like that time in our lives when you started the podcast, when we first started dating, and when we all worked together at WGN Radio. And, you know, thinking about who was there at the beginning. And so that's where I thought, if I'm going to have a mystery guest, like, the only obvious choice is your dear, dear friend, Andy Herman. So, Andy, come on out.
Do you want?
Oh, you can. We have one mic. Okay.
No, you can pull the mic. Pull that one over. Andy, so I mentioned, so this is something. So Andy Herman and I started Outside the Loop in 2006. He was also, he was a producer at WGN Radio as well. And I walk in to here, Fitzgerald's today, and Jenny's like, we got to go to the Baby Gold. We got to check in with the sound guy. I'm like, okay, I'm hauling all this stuff. And I go in, and Andy and his wife Maggie are just sitting there eating. So this was a surprise to me, certainly in that moment, a few hours ago. And I apparently you're staying at our house tonight. So okay.
That's
okay.
True.
Andy Herman, who, by the way, now you live in Nebraska.
I do.
And you are you are still in radio. This guy is NPR famous in Nebraska. I'm not kidding.
Woo-hoo! He's kind of a big deal.
As famous as you can be in Nebraska.
Yes.
Yeah.
You are on the air at Nebraska Public Radio.
A little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. A little bit.
I'm sitting down there like as a fellow radio producer because that's my main job, and I'm just thinking, what's he going to have to edit out for the radio?
The
whole
edit,
time I'm like, I'm like making notes, mental notes.
See, that's why this guy's amazing. The edit's going to be pretty righteous. I'm
a lot of door slams.
A lot of door slams on screaming. It's funny because when you have these on, you hear everything that these hear, and I'm hearing a lot. So we'll fix it though in post, as we like to say. So I got to say, Andy is one of the most talented people I know. He just gets storytelling. He gets radio. And I'll just really quickly here. Do you remember the night when we conceived the show? That sounds weird. when we came up with the show?
There were a few nights we didn't remember.
That's right. So we were in our 20s. And, you know, Andy and I wanted, we were at WGN. And it was a great place. It is a great place. I met Jenny there. But we wanted to tell stories of Chicago that maybe people weren't telling. And so we were coming up with this idea. And it's funny, I'm looking at some friends in the audience. The term Outside the Loop, I don't think I came up with it. I think it was we were going to do this like Underground Magazine kind of thing. And someone else came up with it, but it never went anywhere. So I'm like, well, they're not doing it. So Outside the Loop. But we were at Cleo's. Bar on Chicago Avenue, late night.
Yep.
And it's an awesome place. We kind of scribbled it out on a napkin, the idea for the first show, right? Mm-hmm. And what that looked like and the concept that we had of it. And I'll show you this. This is it. This is the napkin.
This is the relic.
Not surprise me that you still have that.
No.
That's
me
awesome.
Either.
I collect things. Like my brother Steve Krakow over there. So this is the bar napkin that says Outside the Loop, and it's got with Mike Steven and Andy Herman on there. And I like to say that this napkin changed my life. It really did. And because, I mean, I'm sitting here after 1,000 shows, and Andy was there for like hundreds of them before.
I quit twice.
You're the prodigal son, man.
You keep coming back.
You did quit twice, but I mean, it was never bad. It's just like,
no.
Hey, we're not making any money. So, you know, and I just, you know, kept doing it. But you're doing radio in Nebraska, NPR. Can we give it up for NPR today, please?
Yeah.
How you doing over there, bud?
We're pushing forward. Yeah. We're making do with less. We're doubling down on our programming, you know, getting a lot of Nebraska local programming content out there, doing the best we can in a very challenging time.
Yeah. And you're doing, in a way, in Nebraska with some of the culture and arts programming that I like to think we do here with this show. I mean, was it Curious Nebraska, the thing that you've worked on?
Yeah, Curious Nebraska is a series I'm doing where I travel around the state trying to find kind of strange or quirky or unknown stuff about the state. And I approach it as an outsider learning about Nebraska. And I mean, I got to say, us working together all these years, you know, it got me really curious about stuff. Your passion for Chicago and the history and everything going on, it's really sharpened my mission, I believe.
Well, I'm here to sharpen that mission, baby. Yeah. I'm here. Look, I'm so excited that you're here. I guess we'll be hanging out later.
Yeah.
I couldn't be here without you. So I just want to tell you that. And, you know, everyone, what's the website that we can all stream? Because we're all going to stream what's going on in Nebraska. Right?
Yeah.
What's
NebraskaPublicMedia.org.
NebraskaPublicMedia.org.
Yeah.
And, what's that?
/Curious is my show, Curious Nebraska.
Oh, so that's the website, NebraskaPublicMedia.org/curious.
Yeah, to get to that show specifically.
Got it. And we should all go there. Hey, Nebraska, is it okay?
It's like fine.
The state?
It's fine. Yeah. I moved from Chicago after 20 years to New York City for 3 years, and then we moved to Lincoln, Nebraska. It's quite a difference. And I'm that was 5 years ago. I'm still getting used to it. It's a fine town. It's a nice state, but it's a lot different.
Nebraska.
Yeah.
Good tacos over there or no?
Not as good as Chicago.
That's what I'm saying.
Better than New York.
Better than New York?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Controversy, breaking news over here. I love you, man. I'm so happy that you're here.
Thank you for
being
here. I'm
thrilled to be here. And I just want to thank Jenny.
Yeah.
Very supportive. And this promotion, this stuff put together was way more than what I would ever have done.
Yeah.
And just the support here and the mutual respect. And I also want to shout out my wife, Maggie, because we all worked at WGN together.
We did, yes.
And I want to ask, did that napkin come before or after we were shot down by previous management at WGN?
Is this going to be edited out?
We'll see. We'll see if this makes the cut. So we pitched this. I don't know if I brought the napkin in. I probably did.
Yeah.
We pitched this to the management at the time in 2006 at WGN. And remember what they told us?
Bad timing.
It was bad timing. We just don't do it. And we're like, no. See, it's a podcast. Like, it's free. Like, you don't have to do anything. There's already microphones and boards and buttons. We'll just sit here. We'll do a show, and you put it on your website for zero money. Like, I don't know.
What a business plan.
Right? So we just said, let's do it on our own. And I think, actually, the first time I heard about podcasting was from Maggie.
Was it?
It was like, she was saying this thing about podcasting. I'm like, what is that? Because we all had iPods at the time. Yeah. And
she was the one who, you and I were frustrated producers trying to get the show off the ground.
Yeah.
Moaning about WGN turning us down. And Maggie was the one who said, just put it online.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maggie. God, Maggie, everybody. Yeah.
I will say a month before our wedding, so it was kind of a busy time too.
That's right.
Yeah.
I remember the first part of your wedding. Anyway.
Me too.
Yeah. I think I had a recorder at your wedding.
No.
Yeah, we don't need that.
It's in the past.
Andy Herman, I love you. Thank you for being here.
Love you too. All right. Thank you.
Okay, wait. Can I?
Yeah.
This is still my segment, right?
Okay. Yeah. Please, by the way, please keep going to the bar. And take care of our bartenders tonight. Thank you. It gets better as you go to the bar more often, I like to think.
Okay, well, I know we're a little over time, so I'll make it quick. But I just wanted to... Well, I know you're going to do your thank yous and everything, but I just wanted to, again, congratulate you in this room full of friends, family, neighbors,
listeners,
fans, listeners. And just, you know, you... you talk about, you know, doing this for no money when you started it, and like, and truly, like, you get very little for doing this. And it, and you said before it's a labor of love, and it truly is. Like, he spends. And like he said before, he's a full-time high school history teacher, and that is a labor of love for him as well. But the number of hours that he spends on this during a week, and he never complains about it or is like, what am I going to do for this week? Well, sometimes you say, what am I going to do for this week's show? But
they don't all flow as easily.
Always,
yeah.
You're always excited about it and engaged. And I actually, like, several times have said to you, like, you know, like, you can do like a podcast like season, like that's a thing now. Like, but he like never takes a week off. He will bring this board like when we're traveling on vacation in Wisconsin or Michigan, and you pour so much love into it. And I'll steal a line that you always use where you talk about that doing this show is like a form of community service for you. And you talked a lot about your love of community, and I just think that is such a wonderful thing and more important than ever now in the time that we live in. And I'm just really proud of you. And I know that our boys are really proud of you. Mikey and Joey wanted to come up here and say that as well. You're just a wonderful example for them as well. Mikey and Joey, is there anything that you want to say to Dad?
You got to say it in the microphone.
Not really. I'm just saying that he's a great dad and he's great at his job.
All right, Joey, anything you'd like to say?
Great shows, Dad.
So, congratulations. We're incredibly proud of you. We love you very much.
Yep. Well, God, thank you. Well, I don't know what I can say after that, but I'll try. I just wanted to say, as we're wrapping up the 1,000th show here at Fitzgerald's, thank you all for being here today. This is amazing to have you all here. I want to say thank you again to Fitzgerald's. I mean, what an awesome place. Our bartenders, Brett and Amelia, who are running sound. The listeners of the show, you know, some email me and get in touch with me. And it's just amazing that you're consuming this stuff and you're responding to it. So I say thank you to all the listeners. I do want to thank WGN Radio because the current management says, hey, come on, do the show. So it's a tremendous place. Like I said, I met Jenny at WGN. I worked with Andy and Maggie and Bob Ferguson, who's here, who's the engineer who like pushes the buttons during Outside the Loop, who's right there, who's an amazing guy, Bob Ferguson. Thank you. I want to thank... look at these balloons. I didn't do that, but Pam Jacknow did. Thank you to Pam Jacknow. And I don't know if this will make it in, but her husband, Matt, built me a bar in the backyard. And so, real quick, Pam is also a sailor. She sails on Lake Michigan. She's done the Mac race. And I've interviewed her on this show for being a, like, who, like, that's cool. Who knows someone that's done the Mac race? What's that like? And he's like, hey, dude, I'm like your best friend since we were 12. You ever going to have me on the show? I'm like, I don't know. So there you are, man. You made it. Congratulations. You got it, buddy. Thanks to all of our guests. I mean, what a great guest lineup. Everyone just fascinating. Doing, I think, just tremendous work in the community, and just really, that's what I want to bring to all of you who listen to the show, is there are so many interesting things happening that we don't know about that are often right in our faces, and we should celebrate that, especially in a time when we're told maybe we shouldn't. We should celebrate that, right? Because what makes us stronger is each other, and I have always believed that. And I hope that what I do, this little slice of radio and podcasting, can foster more community. I want to thank Andy Herman again. I also want to thank Colin Seaman, who's at the bar just with a cool guy pose right there. He also produced the show for years and is a tremendous videographer and photographer. And I didn't know that he was going to be taking pictures today. So, Colin, thank you. I love you. Colin's great. Yeah.
I think he took a few of me.
He took a few of you? All right, did you sign any releases? Are you going to get some money for that?
I'm not sure.
Not sure? Yeah, all right. Got to work on that with you, bud. I want to say thank you to friends that are here from far and wide, WGN Radio listeners, and my family. My in-laws are here, Jenny's parents, Jay and Mary Beth Eck, who are tremendous people. They're amazing, great, the best in-laws you could have. The number one fan of mine, my mom, is here. She always, after the show airs, she'll call me and give me notes on the show. But the notes are never not good. It's always like, this was a really good one. And like the last week, that was a really good one. And the week before, that was a really good one. So it's always positive notes. So I really appreciate that from you, Mom. So keep it up. Of course, my dad, who's not here with us right now, but you know, he's a huge, tremendous influence on my life. And these people right here. These two kids, I want them to look at their dad and who's done something meaningful and impactful, and I'm trying. So hopefully you can look back on the audio archives of all 1,000 shows by the, you know, plus by the time you get old enough to really get into this stuff, and you can listen. It'll take you 20 years to do. And the best person I know right here, Jenny, I hope everyone has someone like her in their lives, or will, because it's made my life so much better, and I'm inspired by you. So thank you for letting me do all this, and you know, when I'm going off recording stuff, and you're handling the kids and things like that, and it's a good life. I'll just say that. And with that, I say thank you for being here. The Outside the Loop 1,000th episode. Live at Fitzgerald's. Come on back to Fitzgerald's. There's a poster. Mikey is getting the hang of this thing. Thank you for being here.